The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. This program was originally broadcast live on 93.9 KPDQ. We hope you enjoy the show.
Well, good afternoon and welcome to the Monday edition of the Georgene Rice Show. Glad to have you with us. Today we're going to talk with Chris Gould. He is the Senior Vice President of National Program Development and Ministry Relations for Salem Media Group. We're going to talk about the Pastor Appreciation Month events every Thursday this month of October. It's our way of saying thank you. We appreciate you. We want to encourage you and help equip you to continue to minister in our communities through this pandemic in particular. Now, this is our effort to replace what would have been an in-person live pastor appreciation event during the month of October. And Chris Gould will tell you more about that. And we just, again, want to extend our gratitude to pastors and ministry leaders in this community. We'll also talk with Brent McDonald, who has written a very interesting book on the subject of forgiveness. The title, Forever Unforgivable, Learning to Forgive the Inexcusable for Christ's Sake. Would you and I be willing to forget those whose sins are great, perhaps greater than our own, have had an impact on hundreds, if not thousands of people? We're going to talk about that with Brent McDonald, and it is a book that challenges us all, very relevant during this season. Well, today is Columbus Day. I was reminded when I went to the mailbox this morning and there was nothing there. Well, it's a national holiday. Well, do we celebrate Columbus Day any longer? I know some people celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day. And in fact, the violence in downtown, I believe it was in the downtown area over the weekend, had to do with the acts of rage against those colonizers, as they were referred to, and two statues were toppled in the city of Portland. Well, what's the truth behind Christopher Columbus? Is he the evil, raging colonizer, or was there some other history to his founding of this country and his exploration? Now, you can draw your own conclusions, but I thought a bit of history might be helpful. In this last time that we can celebrate Columbus Day, there's the question, is it the last time? Have we gotten to the point where we cannot celebrate anything because of the lack of perfection, which you'll never find in anyone save one? But a wave of cities have decided to remove the holiday from the calendar and replace it with Indigenous Peoples Day. They certainly can choose to do that. Christopher Columbus, the Italian explorer credited with discovering America, and his legacy, as you probably know, are under attack figuratively and increasingly literally. We saw an example of that here in Portland. Well, several Columbus monuments have been attacked and vandalized around the country. The towering Columbus statue in Columbia Circle in New York City now needs 24-hour guards after Mayor Bill de Blasio put it on the list of commissions to review offensive memorials. Offensive. Now, according to Far Left Watch, which is a watchdog organization, Antifa and other left-wing groups plan to deface and attack Columbus statues across the country on Columbus Day. Here in our area, it wasn't Columbus, but under the same guise of Indigenous rage, two statues were toppled. Well, it's unfortunate to see what was once a uniting figure who represented American courage, optimism, and even immigrants is suddenly in the crosshairs for destruction, as is virtually anyone these days. We owe it to Columbus and ourselves to be more respectful of the man who made the existence of our country possible, warts and all. And I think if we look hard enough, we'll find that virtually every figure in human history who has done good has some warts. Well, a few historians and activists began to attack Columbus's legacy in the latter part of the 20th century. They concocted a narrative of Columbus as a rapacious pillager and a genocidal maniac. Well, is that the truth? Well, far left historian Howard Zinn, and I think you know my opinion on the impact he's had on education, he in particular had a huge impact on changing the minds of a generation of Americans about the Columbus legacy. Zinn not only maligned Columbus, but he attacked the larger migration from the old world to the new that he ushered in. So it wasn't just Columbus himself, but other Europeans who were coming. It wasn't just Columbus who was a monster, according to Zinn. It was the driving ethos of the civilization that ultimately developed in the wake of his discovery the United States. Behind the English invasion of North America, he wrote, behind their massacre of Indians, their deception, their brutality, was that special powerful drive born in civilizations based on private profit. Well, the truth is that Columbus set out for the New World thinking he would spread Christianity to regions where it didn't exist. And while Columbus and certainly his Spanish benefactors had an interest in the goods and the gold that he would return with from what they thought would be Asia, the explorer primarily had a motivation that was religious. This conviction that God destined him to be an instrument for spreading the faith was far more potent than his desire to win glory, wealth, and worldly honors, wrote historian Samuel Eliot Morrison over a half century ago. In fact, as contemporary historian Carol Delaney wrote, even the money Columbus sought was primarily dedicated to religious purposes. Delaney said in an interview with the Catholic fraternal organization, the Knights of Columbus, everybody knows that Columbus was trying to find gold, but they didn't know what the gold was for, to fund a crusade to take Jerusalem back from the Muslims before the end of the world. A lot of people at the time thought that the apocalypse was coming because of all the signs, the plague, the famine, earthquakes, and so forth. And it was believed that before the end, Jerusalem had to be back in Christian hands so that Christ could return in judgment. Well, Columbus critics don't just stop at accusing him of greed. One of the biggest allegations against him is that he waged a genocidal war and engaged in acts of cruelty against indigenous peoples of America. But historians like Delaney have debunked these claims. Rather than cruel, Columbus was mostly benign in his interactions with native populations. And while deprivations did occur, Columbus was quick to punish those under his command who committed unjust acts against local populations. Columbus strictly told the crew not to do things like maraud or rape, and instead to treat the native people with respect. There are many examples, Delaney writes in his writings, where he gave instructions to this effect. Most of the time when injustice occurred, Columbus wasn't even there. There were terrible diseases that got communicated to the natives, but he can't be blamed for that. Well, yes, he can in the 21st century. Columbus certainly wasn't a man without flaws or attitudes that would be unacceptable today. Keep in mind that there will be flaws and attitudes that will be unacceptable tomorrow, held by those who are self-righteous today. Even as a man of an earlier age in which violence and cruelty were often the norm between different cultures and people, Columbus didn't engage in the savage acts that have been pinned on him. For much of the 19th and 20th centuries, most Americans were taught about Columbus' discovery of the New World in school. In 1492, Columbus sailed the Ocean Blue, we recall, when a popular poem about the Italian explorer who flew under the Spanish flag. At one time, Americans marveled at what seemed like an unbelievably courageous voyage across unknown waters with the limited tools and maps of the 15th century. It's difficult in the 21st century to imagine what Columbus faced as he crossed the Atlantic in search of what he thought was a route to Asia. The hardship, the danger was immense. If things went awry, there would be nothing to save his little flotilla besides hope, prayer, and a little courage. Most people, even in the 1490s, knew that the earth was round. However, Columbus made a nevertheless history-altering discovery. The world was a much bigger place than most had imagined. And though Columbus never personally realized the scope of his discovery, he opened up a new world that would one day become a forefront of human civilization. Now, this is the man and the history that earlier generations of Americans came to respect and admire. These days, respect and admiration are of lesser qualities. Unfortunately, Howard Zinn and others caricature the Columbus journey and American civilization, and it's stuck. And in an era in which radicals and activists search the country for problematic statues to destroy, Columbus is a prime target. It's also interesting to point out that the Ku Klux Klan pushed anti-Columbus rhetoric during their heyday. Much of the modern rhetoric about Columbus mirrored attacks lobbed at him in the 19th century by anti-Catholic, anti-Italian groups like the Ku Klux Klan. In fact, Columbus Day became a nationally celebrated holiday following a mass lynching of Italians in New Orleans, the largest incident of lynching in American history. Italians. In 1892, the 400th anniversary of the Columbus voyage, President Benjamin Harrison called for a national celebration of Columbus and his achievements. Americans patriotically celebrated Columbus, erected numerous statues in his honor as the country embraced him. Now, you don't have to, but this is what happened then. Though America appreciated Columbus, it deepened. Some groups weren't pleased at the time. As the pro-Columbus website, The Truth About Columbus, points out, the Ku Klux Klan, they worked to stop Columbus Day celebrations. They smashed reversed statues, reversed his growing influence on American culture. And according to The Truth About Columbus, in the 1920s, the Klan attempted to remove Columbus Day as a state holiday in Oregon, burned a cross to disturb a Columbus Day celebration in Pennsylvania, and successfully opposed the erection of a statue of Columbus in Richmond, Virginia, only to see the decision to reject the statue reversed. Attempts to squash Columbus failed, but they have reemerged in our own time through the actions of groups primarily on the left who want to see his legacy buried and diminished forever. Now, this would be a tragic loss for our generation and those in the future. The bravery and boldness that Columbus displayed in his trek to America have been inherent in the American cultural DNA from the beginning. Now, adding to that indigenous people, I'm all for it. At the expense of Columbus, warts and all, I would... suggest we celebrate both. We may never have the class, the taste, the sophistication of the old world upper crust, but what we do have is a reverence for simple virtues of strength, boldness, and a willingness to push the envelope to secure for ourselves a better future than those who've come before. We are a civilization that admires those who push the limits of the frontier. We don't merely accept what is and want something more. The spirit that drove us west and in modernity, and I say we advisedly, I was brought here in the bowels of my ancestors, that's brought us as a nation to the moon in what we celebrate in men like Columbus. President Ronald Reagan said it best in a Columbus Day tribute: Columbus is justly admired as a brilliant navigator, a fearless man of action, a visionary who opened the eyes of an older world to an entirely new one. Above all, he personifies a view of the world that many see as quintessentially American, not merely optimistic, but scornful of the very notion of despair, end quote. When we have lost these things, when we are no longer have the capacity to celebrate men like Columbus and add to that list others we should celebrate, as imperfect as they sometimes were, we will have lost what has made us great and distinct. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. We'll be back.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
If you're listening to The Georgine Rice Show, coming up later this hour, we're going to talk with Chris Gould. He's a senior vice president with the Salem Media Group. We're going to remind you of all the important details for this Pastor Appreciation Month series of events every Thursday in October. We'll also talk with Brent McDonald. He's the author of Forever Unforgivable, Learning to Forgive the Inexcusable for Christ's Sake. Well, if you're among the handful of people who've been diligently watching the NBA finals, and by the way, there were far fewer of them than just a regular game for the NFL, you might have missed the news. Judge Amy Coney Barrett's Senate confirmation hearings began this morning. Well, the hearings, which take place in the 22-member Senate Judiciary Committee, kicked off at about 9 a.m. Eastern Time today. They're going to run through Thursday. Well, today's session began with an introductory statement by Republican Chairman Lindsey Graham and Ranking Member Dianne Feinstein, following 10-minute opening statements by each committee member, including Kamala Harris, who's the vice presidential running mate to Joe Biden. Then an introduction of Judge Barrett by Indiana Senator Todd Young and former Notre Dame Law School Dean Patricia O'Hara, who, by the way, with technical problems, spoke after Amy Coney Barrett spoke for herself. Well, Barrett will then deliver her opening remarks, which she did, in which she praised two deceased giants of the Supreme Court, Antonin Scalia, who was her mentor, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg, whose death on September 18th, made available this seat on the high court Barrett is being called upon to fill. Barrett is a constitutional originalist in the mold of Scalia, is also expected to stress that it's the court's responsibility to enforce the rule of law, not to solve every problem or right every wrong, and that the policies and value judgments of government must be made by the two branches of government that are accountable to the American people at the ballot box. That would be the Senate and the House and the Executive. Well, the full text of her opening remarks can be found online, by the way. But none of this will matter to Senate Democrats, as they have already mapped out their strategy and spoon-fed it to an eager, obedient mainstream media. Well, the strategy was rolled out on Sunday morning's news talk shows. Delaware Democrat Senator Chris Coons, a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, argued that the GOP's efforts to seat Judge Barrett before the end of President Donald Trump's 4-year term constitutes, wait for it, court packing. which, if you know what court packing actually is, would not constitute court packing, but it sure sounds good as a soundbite. This despite the term clear, its clear meaning related to expanding the number of seats on the court and filling those seats with ideologically like-minded justices. I'm going to be laying out the ways in which Judge Barrett's views are not just extreme, he went on to say. They're disqualifying, Coons said. Confirmation, he added, constitutes court packing. Well, it's a nice play on words, but certainly inaccurate. Well, Illinois Democrat Dick Durbin, also a member of the Judiciary Committee, likewise corrupted the meaning of the term, saying the American people have watched Republicans pack the court over the last 3.5 years, and they brag about it, that they've taken every vacancy and filled it, which is, of course, their constitutional responsibility. That's not court packing, if you understand what it means. Well, this perversion of a particular term has a purpose. Democrats are trying to turn the tables on what has, for the past 2 weeks, become an uncomfortable and unanswerable question for their president's presidential nominee, Joe Biden. Time after time, Biden has been called upon to answer a simple but critical question, whether he would pack the Supreme Court with liberal justices if elected. Now, if you go back historically, he has said it certainly would be constitutionally viable. I mean, you could do it, but it's a really stupid idea. He's seen on tape and video making that statement some decades ago. Well, at every turn now, he's refused to tell the voters what his plans are. In fact, he said, you don't deserve to know, claiming that his answer would immediately become a focus of attention. Well, yeah, it would change the way a constitutional republic and the separation of powers would work. Of course, any effort to illegitimately pack the Supreme Court, which has worked perfectly well with 9 justices for the past 151 years, deserves the American people's undivided attention. Well, Biden's answer or lack of answer on whether the American people have the right to know his position, well, his answer, no, they don't. No less, a Trump-hating leftist like Jake Tapper has even grown tired of the Biden campaign's disingenuous narrative. How is confirmation not constitutional? He repeatedly asked Biden, Biden's caked betting field. Tapper, whose facial expressions tend to betray his feelings, looked like he was eating a bag of lemons as she continued to duck and dodge the question. Well, Nebraska Senator Ben Sasse also registered his contempt. It's grotesque that Vice President Biden won't answer that real basic question. And it isn't just one branch of government. What Democrats are really talking about or refusing to talk about is the suicide bombing of 2 branches of government, end quote. By the way, that's not an overstatement. Well, that pretty much sums up the Democrats' disparate game plan. The next few days will determine whether the media allows them to get away with it. Much of the tack today in the early hearing, when the senators had their opportunity to make their 10-minute statements, was that Amy Coney Barrett would put an end to Obamacare based on a comment she made in a paper back in 2017, in which she commented on one small aspect of a decision that had been made by one of the justices, in which she challenges the legal thinking behind that decision. That has now been blown up to mean that on day one, Amy Coney Barrett would vote against Obamacare and that it would end the moment she is confirmed and sworn into that position. Well, it's, again, disingenuous and inaccurate to say so. Based on what she has actually said, we have no idea where she would stand on the question of Obamacare. And the comment she made on one aspect of an earlier decision back in 2017 is not the question that the Supreme Court in 2021 will be addressing with regard to the Affordable Care Act. Well, we're going to take a break in about 2 minutes. But when we come back, I want to talk about some things to watch for in these hearings. Now, they start in earnest tomorrow because that's when senators have an opportunity to spend a lengthier time primarily pontificating, but occasionally asking a relevant question. The Senate Judiciary Committee hearing for the nominee kicked off today at the questioning of the former Notre Dame law professor this week. Will steal much of the spotlight away from the ongoing election between President Trump and Joe Biden, especially with a debate that was originally scheduled for Thursday, now canceled. And we'll talk more about that later in the program. Well, the proceedings are expected to last through Thursday. Senators will spend Monday making their opening statements, which they did, followed by Barrett's opening remarks before the questioning begins tomorrow and will continue into Wednesday. On Thursday, the Senate will bring it outside experts to weigh in on the nomination. Republicans at that point appear to have the votes needed to confirm Judge Barrett, with only 2 members of the 53-person caucus objecting to moving the Barrett nomination before the election. That means that they can afford one unexpected defection and still have Vice President Pence be able to break the tie. We'll see how that falls out. It appears unlikely that Republican senators who voiced their support for the process would suddenly turn against a Republican Supreme Court nominee on the substance. Democrats are largely resigned that they have no procedural tools to stand in the way of the determined Senate GOP. But Barrett will first have to survive multiple days of being grilled by senators in front of a nationwide broadcast and audience. And we'll talk when we come back in just a few moments on some of the things to watch for in the Amy Coney Barrett confirmation here. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. Back in a moment.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show on this lovely Monday afternoon. We're talking about the hearings that began for Amy Coney Barrett. They began earlier today, but the questioning in earnest begins tomorrow. And so some things to listen for, whether Democrats bring up religion and how they do it, if they do, will be a key focus of the hearings. It seems that the tack has shifted away from her Catholicism, although that continues to be brought up from time to time, and shifted to Obamacare, which is rather peculiar since she's not likely to have much of an impact on that subject at all. Senate Judiciary Committee Democrats have a history of grilling nominees on their Christian faith, and specifically Amy Coney Barrett. Ranking Member Dianne Feinstein, during her Seventh Circuit Court confirmation hearing back in 2017, told Barrett, "The dogma lives loudly within you, and that's of concern." It sounds sort of like, who's that green character from Star Wars? Anyway, the comments earned Democrats significant bad press, helped make Barrett a star among Republicans, who have signaled that they plan to make any Democrat comments about Barrett's faith a major issue. Some Democrats have made clear that they're not going to be grilling Barrett on her religion this time around, and instead will focus on her perceived stances on the Affordable Care Act, which faces a constitutional challenge at the Supreme Court just days after the presidential election. Roe versus Wade, the Supreme Court ruling that prevents states from banning abortion, is also a major issue for Democrats, and they fear Barrett would rule against the precedent and that her religion might bias her. Barrett has repeatedly said judges' faith should not impact how they carry out their duties, and the Senate Judiciary Committee member Mays Hirano said in response to a reporter after a press conference last week, her faith is irrelevant, but what is relevant is what the real issue is, whether her closely held views can be separated from her ability to make objective, fair decisions with her lifetime appointment. Another thing to look for is Barrett's response on health care for the reasons I've just mentioned. Before joining the federal bench, she had a critical NFIB versus Sebelius, the Supreme Court ruling that initially upheld the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act during the Obama administration. Democrats are asking her and are certain to ask her tough questions about that in California versus Texas, the constitutional challenge to the ACA set to be argued in early November. Now, that's something she will have an opportunity to weigh in on. Well, Barrett almost certainly will dodge any such questions. Judicial nominees tend to say it would be inappropriate for them to weigh in on any issue that could come before the bench. But how Barrett phrases her answers on the Democrats' Affordable Care Act question will be closely watched and aggressively dissected. Well, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer has already called for Barrett to recuse herself from the California versus Texas, a case which would be far outside of the realm of judicial norms. Democrats have also called on Barrett to recuse herself from any election-related cases simply because she was nominated by Trump. Another thing to look for is whether or not Senator Kamala Harris, the vice presidential running mate of Joe Biden, will steal the spotlight. She certainly will try to take advantage of the spotlight she will hold for her 10 minutes of Q&A. I think there's probably more pressure on Kamala to actually engage in a political way than ever before, just because of the fact that she's on the ticket with Vice President. White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows said of Senator Kamala Harris, who's on the Judiciary Committee, at a virtual event on Article 3 Project, a group that supports Trump's judicial nominees. Harris's role in those hearings will be closely watched. She's not just one of the highest profile senators on the committee, but also the Democratic vice presidential nominee. Her ticket is leading significantly in the polls, and any misstep could jeopardize that. But a stellar performance in questioning the nominee by the former prosecutor could also essentially serve as an hour-long Biden-Harris campaign commercial. Senators get 10 minutes opening statements, 30 minutes each to question Barrett. That's Tuesday and Wednesday, and 20 more on Wednesday. So this is going to take a long time. Another question is the idea of court packing, as Joe Biden and Kamala Harris steadfastly refuse to tell voters whether they will pack the Supreme Court if elected. The topic has become one of the top issues in the presidential election and in the Barrett confirmation fight as well. Now, some Democrats, including multiple senators, they've called for court packing, which means adding justices to the Supreme Court by law, and then filling those seats with judges that would approve of your policies, not strict constitutionalists, but activist judges. Former President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, he proposed to pack the Supreme Court during his presidency after the Supreme Court continually ruled against the constitutionality of his New Deal policies, but it was fiercely opposed even by his own party. Well, Democrats more recently, they've accused Republicans of court packing by moving to confirm Barrett and focusing on filling vacant seats in the lower federal court, which is not what court packing means, but you get the idea. Expect such accusations to fly from both sides and throughout the week, but especially during Monday's opening statements. It came up. It will continue to come up, I suspect. Then there's the health of GOP members. Now, three Republican senators were diagnosed with the coronavirus around the same time the president was, two of whom are in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Their recoveries will be key in allowing the Senate to advance Barrett's nomination out of the committee and eventually confirm her. Senators Tom Tillis and Mike Lee are the Senate Judiciary Committee members currently on the mend. Tillis said last week that he is feeling better and believes he will be testing negative on Thursday for when the committee begins its markup of the Barrett nomination. At least one of Tillis or Lee will likely need to be able to attend in person on the 22nd, which is when the Judiciary Committee Chairman Lindsey Graham plans to hold the committee vote on Barrett. Well, then members will need to be on the Senate floor to vote in person for her roll call confirmation vote, which is likely to happen the following week. But any other Republicans testing positive, or Tillis, Lee, or Senator Ron Johnson taking longer than expected to recover from the virus could pose significant logistical issues for Republicans and potentially even lead to a delay in the confirmation. And then there is the campaign element. The fact remains this entire confirmation process is happening against the backdrop of a presidential election. Now, some on the right have even argued that Barrett is now Trump's de facto new running mate. Well, as Republicans largely are seen as having the votes to confirm Barrett on their own terms, success or failure in the hearings this week may largely be measured based on whether or how they move the presidential polls. So you can watch for what happens. Given the fact that the presidential debate has been canceled, all eyes will remain focused in Washington on those ongoing hearings. By the way, some Democratic opponents of the U.S. Supreme Court nominee are criticizing her conservative Catholic beliefs, but three out of four voters say a candidate's religious faith should not determine whether he or she can serve on the high court. Well, the latest Rasmussen polls, it's a national telephone and online survey, finds that just 16% likely U.S. voters think a nominee's religion should be a deciding factor in determining who sits on the Supreme Court. 73% reject that position and say religious faith should not be a determining factor. Because the Catholic Church opposes abortion, 14% believe Catholics should be prohibited from sitting on the Supreme Court. 77% disagree. Joe Biden and Nancy Pelosi, both pro-abortion, are Catholic. Well, John Yoo says, if senators do attack Amy Coney Barrett's faith, here's the reply she must give. He says that Democrats complain that the spread of the coronavirus makes it impossible for the Senate to consider her nomination on the ambitious table demanded by Republicans. And if they were to exercise the good judgment and wisdom that once characterized their predecessors, he writes that senators should quickly confirm Barrett because of her intelligence, qualifications, and character. And I have to say, she is quite impressive based on those measures. She graduated first in her class at Notre Dame Law School, clerked for Justice Antonin Scalia of the Supreme Court, returned to Notre Dame faculty, has served as a federal appellate judge for the last 3 years. What else can senators expect? Was she supposed to cure cancer and bring peace to the Middle East too? One might wonder, but even if you do that, I'm not sure she would make the cut. Well, if Democrat senators, he writes, pursue this line of attack, Barrett might respond thusly, and I'm quoting, "I believe in an America that is officially neither Catholic, Protestant, nor Jewish, where no public official either requests or accepts instructions on public policy from the Pope, the National Council of Churches, or any other ecclesiastical source, where no religious body seeks to impose its will directly or indirectly upon the general populace or the public acts of its officials, and where religious liberty is so indivisible that an act against one church is treated as an act against all." Nicely put. He's suggesting that that's the response she should give when the issue, not if, but when the issue rears its head during these hearings. Well, I think I'm out of time, so I'm going to end right there. But I do need to take a break, and we'll be back. So stay with us. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, we're back. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. I want to remind you, coming up in the 5 o'clock hour, we'll talk with Chris Gould. He is Senior Vice President of National Program Development and Ministry Relations for the Salem Media Group. We'll talk about the Pastor Appreciation events all this month, every Thursday. You can find out more at kpdq.com. And we hope if you are a pastor, a ministry leader, that you will take advantage of this opportunity to be encouraged and to hear from some of the leading Christian teachers from across the country. Chris Gould will join us to extend that invitation. We'll also talk with Brent McDonald. Forever Unforgivable is the title of his book, Learning to Forgive the Inexcusable for Christ's Sake. Brent McDonald also joining us in the 5 o'clock hour. One more word about Amy Coney Barrett. Judge Barrett presented her judicial outlook as drawing on that of former Justice Antonin Scalia at the end of the hearing today, hearings, during her opening statement to the Senate Judiciary Committee. Well, she clerked for Scalia in the late 90s, has since worked as a lawyer, and is currently a judge in the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. Scalia's judicial philosophy was straightforward. A judge must apply the law as it is written, not as she wishes it were, Barrett said. Courts are not designed to solve every problem or right every wrong in our public life. She continued, the policy decisions and value judgments of government must be made by the political branches, elected by and accountable to the people. The public should not expect courts to do so, and courts should not try to, end quote. Well, as you know, Republicans are pushing to confirm her to the court before the November elections, a move that Democrats have vociferously opposed. If Barrett is confirmed to replace liberal Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, conservatives will make up a six to three majority on the court's bench. Now, what that actually means in terms of decisions remains to be seen. As you well know, there are justices who are appointed by conservative Republican presidents whose judgments run counter to what one might expect. Well, Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden and his running mate, Senator Kamala Harris of California, have been mum on the question of court packing, the actual definition, should they win the November election. But in the he certainly had an opinion on the matter back in 1983 when he called it a bonehead idea. That's an actual quote. Biden then, as U.S. Senator from Delaware, made the comment during a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing in July of 83 regarding nominations to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. At the time, Republican President Ronald Reagan had stoked controversy for attempting to replace three members of the commission. The question of court packing has been evoked in recent weeks amid President Trump's nomination of Judge Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court. Democrats have argued that the next Supreme Court justice ought to be decided by the winner of the November election, and that Barrett's confirmation to the court, so close to the election, no less, would unfairly cement a 6-3 conservative majority on the court. Well, facing pressure to take a stance during a campaign swing through Phoenix on Thursday, Biden said the country would know my position on court packing when the election is over. When asked whether or not the American people have a right to know, he said, no, they do not deserve to know. Well, Biden told reporters they should focus on Republicans after being pressed on his court packing stance or lack thereof. And Republicans have blasted the former vice president for saying voters don't deserve to know court packing stance or his stance. A Biden deputy campaign chair deflected a court packing question as well, saying it's a Republican distraction. And Senator Coons says that confirming Barrett constitutes court packing. Sass responds that obviously is incorrect. If court packing has an actual meaning, President Trump says packing the Supreme Court would permanently destroy the court. Well, the private security guard who has been jailed on suspicion of first degree murder stemming from a deadly shooting on Saturday at a Patriot rally in Denver during dueling protests was reportedly not properly licensed to work in the position. Matthew Robert Dolloff, 30, was reportedly working as a contracted security guard for Nine News at the time of the shooting. The local news station reported late Sunday he was contracted through another company to accompany its news staff to the protests. Well, the station reported that it later found out it appears that Dolloff was not actually employed by the company it used, and the company did not provide additional information about his actual employer. Well, the Nine News report went further and said Denver Department of Excise and Licenses had no record of Dolloff as a licensed security guard. And Doloff, who is 30, was taken into custody in connection with a clash which took place Saturday afternoon in the Civic Center part of Denver. The man who was shot dead was identified by family members as Lee Keltner, a military veteran, a grandfather, and a vowed patriot who was there to express his support for the police. In other developments, the Denver shooting victim has been identified as pro-cop vet shot in front of his son, according to the family. U.S. Navy veteran Joe Collins on Saturday released a scathing campaign ad standing in front of a multi-million dollar mansion, the home of Representative Maxine Waters, and attacked her for living in a multi-million dollar mansion while representing a district plagued by crime and poverty, all while she's not even living in the actual district. In the ad, Collins, her African-American opponent, stands outside of her $6 million California residence before asking viewers, "Do you know where I am right now? Maxine Waters' $6 million mansion. Do you know where I'm where I am not right now?" And that's Maxine Waters' district. Waters has represented the area that is now California's 43rd district since 1991. Before that, she had served in California State Assembly since 76. Her home used to be within the boundaries of District 43 until redistricting shifted her neighborhood into the 37th district, which is represented by Representative Karen Bass. Collins, her opponent, a Republican who's campaigning to replace her and grew up in South Los Angeles, said the crime and poverty in the area have only increased under Waters' 44 years in public office. "I survived a drive-by shooting in this house when I was a child," Collins says in the video while standing outside a home in the area. "Gangs, drugs, violence, that was my upbringing. And where was Maxine Waters, having served more than 13 years in the U.S. Navy, having fought in the Iraq War?" Collins also criticized her for fighting for her own district here in America. Well, Biden says Trump fomented violence, but Dems have their own history of urging confrontation. And Representative Waters was spotted pulling over to confront a police officer in Los Angeles for stopping a black driver, having no idea what the stop was about. Trump told supporters that he tested totally negative for the coronavirus over the weekend. And former Vice President Biden is considering the controversial New York Governor Cuomo as his attorney general if elected. Dr. Fauci says that his comments in the new Trump ad were taken out of context and without his permission. And a Border Patrol agent's hunch has paid off in the second largest methamphetamine bust ever. The Lakers dominated the Heat to capture the 17th NBA title. Not that anyone was there to watch. And the Dak Prescott was carted off the field after a gruesome leg injury in the Cowboys versus Giants game. The White House is pushing for a limited coronavirus relief bill as the broader effort meets resistance. And Bill Gates says Trump's coronavirus treatment won't work for everyone and it shouldn't be called a cure. Senator Lindsey Graham's challenger, Harrison, has shattered the Senate fundraising record with $57 million haul. Well, Jake Tapper, former Vice President Biden's spokeswoman on court packing, saying voters deserve an answer. Apparently, they do not. And the chair of the Republican National Committee has accused the debate commission of election interference. The Ronna McDaniel, the RNC chairwoman, appeared on CBS Face the Nation on Sunday and stated, "I think voters are very frustrated by the corrupt debate commission that they would cancel a second debate," McDaniel told host Margaret Brennan. "I think it feeds into the belief that these 47 years that Joe Biden has had in D.C. is again protecting him from facing the voters. And Americans are frustrated that this election commission interfered with our ability to see these two candidates debate." Meanwhile, former Senator Bob Dole tweeted his displeasure with the commission. "A biased debate commission is unfair." Well, the World Health Organization now condemns lockdowns, citing economic consequences. "We in the World Health Organization do not advocate lockdowns as the primary means to control this virus," the group's envoy, Dr. David Navarro, said, speaking to the World Health leaders and media on Sunday. "The only time we believe a lockdown is justified is to buy your time to reorganize, to regroup, rebalance your resources, protect your health workers who are exhausted. But by and large, we'd rather not do it," end quote. So who to believe, one might ask. From New York Post, back in March, Director General Tedros warned lockdowns should not be lifted. "These measures are the best way to suppress and stop transmission so that when restrictions are lifted, the coronavirus doesn't resurge," he said. "The last thing any country needs is to open schools and businesses only to be forced to close them again because of the resurgence." Well, again, we're getting contradictory reports based on science. By the way, Donald Trump earned his fourth Nobel Peace Prize nomination in 32 days, nominated at this time by a European Parliament representative from Finland. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. News and traffic up next.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
You're listening to the second hour of The Georgene Rice Show. And I have to tell you, I'm pretty thrilled. We have one of the big wigs from Salem Media Group to join us. Chris Gould is the Senior Vice President of National Program Development and Ministry Relations at Salem Media Group. And he joins me to talk about the Pastor Appreciation Month of events that are ongoing. Chris Gould, we are so delighted to have you with us.
Thanks, Georgene. It's great to be with you and all the great folks up there in Portland.
You know, I've mentioned here so many times that the highlight of my Christian year calendar has been the Pastor Appreciation event that we have hosted for many, many years. But given the COVID-19 pandemic, we have not been able to meet together as a group, and everyone understands that dynamic. But what's taken its place is really quite incredible, this virtual Pastor's Appreciation event. Now, we've been talking about this for weeks now, but for listeners who maybe are just learning about it, give us an overview of what we're making available to pastors and ministry leaders in lieu of our Pastor Appreciation singular event.
Sure. Thank you so much, Georgene. Well, we still want to express our deep appreciation for the service of local pastors in local communities. And as you mentioned, 27 years ago, Salem launched this event, the Pastor Appreciation luncheon or breakfast or dinner. Every market does it a little bit differently, but it's a chance where pastors can come together for fellowship and have an opportunity to worship the Lord together, have a good meal, and then hear a message from, you know, one of their heroes. The first speaker, Georgene, was Chuck Swindoll. He went to our market in San Francisco. They met in the basement of an old church, and they ate little sandwiches on paper plates. That was 27 years ago. And, 100 pastors, and Chuck Swindoll came in to encourage them. And last year, we saw 30,000 pastors all over the country at these various events. And so what we've done is we've put it together in a virtual fashion. So pastors there in the Portland area can just go to your website, sign up for free. It's a free event, but you must register, and you can watch the content that we've curated just for them. And it's quite an enjoyable experience. We've spared no expense in securing some of the best preachers in America, including John MacArthur, Tony Evans, Alistair Begg, Brian Chappell, Robert Jeffress, and Chuck Swindoll himself. So it's fantastic content, and we just want pastors to be encouraged during this month of October, which is Pastor Appreciation Month.
Well, in addition to those Bible teachers, and Chuck Swindoll, having been at the very first one 27 years ago, is going to be part of this event moving forward through this month of October, you also have secured some incredible musicians, Chris Tomlin for King and Country, Matthew West, Natalie Grant, and others as well. This is an opportunity for pastors to be encouraged by others who understand the work that God has called them to. What is our primary hope for these pastors who are really in the trenches and during this pandemic season have challenges that they're facing that hasn't been the case since, you know, the first pandemic 100 years ago? What is it that we hope pastors will take away from this time together in this virtual series of events?
Well, Georgene, the pastor is called to preach the word and preach the word to God's people. And so the load during these days for them is especially heavy.
Yes.
Between the social unrest and the COVID-19 restrictions and the economy in difficulty, political divide. So the pastor is in the catbird seat, and he's got a lot of pressure. And so our hope is that they'll take some time, register for free, download this content, watch it, and be encouraged. They'll be equipped. They'll be edified by watching this content. And again, it's curated directly for pastors. So, you know, the only one who really knows what it's like to be a pastor is a pastor. Just like when the pastor heard the call to become a pastor, nobody else heard it, but God called them to be a pastor. And so we believe we've curated content that's going to minister to their heart, to their soul. It's going to encourage them and equip them. And that's what we're here to do, help support local pastors in the local church.
And there's new content every Thursday morning that our pastors can go and download. And I wasn't aware of the fact that if you missed the first two Thursday events, you can go back and find that there as well.
Yeah, that's true. When we put this together, we said, how can we really bless pastors? So at your event, for example, there's been a variety of great pastors over the years.
Yes.
That have come. They've taken a plane, flown up to Portland. You guys put on an amazing event. You got hundreds and hundreds of pastors, great meal, great fellowship, corporate worship, and then one message from one pastor, and it's usually phenomenal. Right? Am I right?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So we said, okay, what about two speakers per episode? So each of these sessions is a 90-minute session and has two phenomenal pastors. So again, this Thursday, we'll be releasing content with Brian Chappell. Dr. Brian Chappell is the host of Unlimited Grace Radio. He's the preacher, Georgine, who teaches the preachers how to preach. He wrote the book Christ-Centered Preaching, Redeeming the Expository Sermon. It's in its second edition. Hundreds of thousands of copies of that are in all our seminaries around the country and really around the world. And so Brian Chappell comes in and he has a message for the pastors. And then also Sam Rodriguez is on this episode coming up on Thursday. Sam's a pastor up in Sacramento, or I guess from Portland down in Sacramento. And and he's also the leader of the Hispanic Church here in America, the National Hispanic Christian Leadership Conference. So these are two phenomenal pastors that can minister to a lot of people, and it'll be a blessing for pastors to download the content and watch it.
Oh, absolutely. You know, while I am sad that I'm not going to have the opportunity to meet together with pastors as our tradition has been, I am delighted that given our current circumstance, this virtual Pastors Appreciation series of events is providing pastors more than one opportunity every Thursday this month, and then content from the last 2 weeks gives them an opportunity to be encouraged and blessed. We recognize that we are not the church. We want to support and minister to those who have been appointed as leaders over God's church. And so this is our way to do just that. And I'm just asking you, pastors, I know you're busy, you may be weary, but we want to encourage you and recognize that given our current circumstances, you might just need a little bit more of that. Go to kpdq.com and register. We want to make sure that you are appreciated, that you know that how highly we regard you and how much we need you. And you can find all of that at kpdq.com. You need to register. You can not only enjoy the event this Thursday morning, but you can go back for the previous two Thursdays and enjoy that as well. This is all sponsored by Cascade Furniture. I want to mention that because we appreciate their support for our pastors. And I am so excited to be associated with a company like Salem Media Group that recognizes the tremendous contribution that pastors make, and to set aside the resource, the time, and the effort to just say thank you. We want to encourage you to continue in the work. We need one another. So thank you for leading in that effort.
You're very welcome. Two quick things before I let you go. One is for those mega church pastors that might be listening, and I know they listen, by the way. I know they listen. A lot of these folks are my friends. There's really no excuse for you now to be able to participate with this event with us. So you can watch it at your convenience, at your home, with your wife, with your family, in your office. You can watch it wherever and whenever you want. So please join us because we've curated it just for you.
Yeah.
And then number two, just a quick story, Georgine. One of the events I went to in Honolulu, one of the pastor appreciation events I attended some years ago, Ravi Zacharias was the keynote speaker. And he did just a phenomenal, phenomenal job. But right after the event, and it was right there on the ocean, you know, a beautiful setting, just fantastic food, great fellowship, great music. And of course, Ravi's message was wonderful. But one of the pastors after the event came up to me and he took a letter, a paper out of his jacket. It was a resignation letter. He said, I came here, I was going to resign from being a pastor at my church. I was going to hand in my resignation letter, but now I'm going to rip this up. Thank you so much. I'm so glad that I was able to get to this event. So that kind of thing invariably happens at all our events. God is at work and the pressure on the pastor is heavy. Let us bless you and encourage you by participating. Just simply register for free and watch the content. It's designed just for you and it'll be a blessing to you.
Oh, I love that. Again, kpdq.com. We love you, pastors. We appreciate you. We want to express that in a constructive way. Chris Gould, it's always a pleasure to talk with you, but a real treat to have you on the show today.
Thanks, Georgine. You're the best. Appreciate it so much.
Thanks for joining us. Again, Chris Gould is Senior Vice President of National Program Developer and Ministry Relations for the Salem Media Group. So pastors, kpdq.com. Hope you'll join us. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, we'll talk with Brent McDonald. He's the author of Forever Unforgivable, Learning to Forgive the Inexcusable for Christ's Sake. So stay with us.
You're listening to the Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Georgine Rice Show. My next guest poses a very serious question. Should Christians forgive and accept atrociously wicked people when they come to faith in Jesus Christ? And what if there were murderers or racists or sexual predators, terrorists, human traffickers, or worse? Well, his book is focused on the unforgivable, and the book allows you to consider the lives of 15 depraved men and women around the world who later found Jesus or were found by Jesus. You can learn how believers reacted at the time, consider what you might do under similar circumstances, and you'll be amazed at who God saves and radically changes. Well, my guest is Brent McDonald. He is a pastor, a teacher, and Bible researcher with a focus on biblical archaeology and the historicity of biblical events. As executive director of Cottage Cove Urban Ministries in Nashville, Tennessee, a ministry for at-risk children and youth, he enables and encourages people to live out lives of love for the least of these. He frequently travels with his wife, Angie, for on-site research in the Bible lands. And today he joins us to talk about his book, Forever Unforgivable, Learning to Forgive the Inexcusable, for Christ's Sake. Brent McDonald, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
This is such an extraordinary book because it isn't just about how we ought to forgive one another, but it poses the very sobering and deep question of how we forgive those whose offenses are so offensive to us that we find it difficult when we learn that they've come to faith in Christ. We think about the example of Saul, and we can perhaps understand how those Christians found it difficult to accept that he had come to faith in Christ, that Jesus had redeemed him, and now he was emerging as one of the leaders in the church. That's one example that comes to mind. What motivated you to take on this subject of the church and we as individual believers embracing those who have received the love and grace and mercy of God that we too have received?
Well, what I was finding was that even in the church, a bit of the world's view regarding past acts is kind of creeping into the church. You hear oftentimes in the world that, you know, whatever that person did in the past just disqualifies them forever from being accepted. And when you start hearing people in the church saying somewhat the same thing, then you have to stop and consider people like Paul. I mean, he did atrocious things before Jesus found him on the road to Damascus.
Does it say more about the individual Christian and their understanding of Scripture? Or does it say more about our underestimation of the grace and mercy of God, the sacrifice that Jesus made and the sufficiency of that sacrifice? What does it expose about us when we point to others and say they are beyond the pale, they're beyond redemption?
Yeah, I think somehow we kind of qualify sin. We think, okay, yeah, I might have stolen a cookie or I might have told that small lie. And, you know, of course, Jesus forgive those things. But, you know, what about that person who did, you know, and fill in the blank on that, the worst thing that you can imagine. And without realizing that all that sin was why Jesus died.
Now, how would you identify or define the idea of evil. It's interpreted in many ways, and in the context of what we're talking about, forever unforgivable, those who have committed atrocious sins by our definition. How would you define it?
Well, it's really to define evil as being any offense against a holy God. And as I said, that can be that so-called minor sin that we think about to the worst atrocious act that you can think about, and the whole spectrum in between. And it's easy for us to try and just dismiss the worst of that as if God's grace isn't sufficient for that.
Now, this book looks at the lives of 15 people you might consider that we all might agree were evil. How did you choose these 15? I know that these are 15 who not only committed atrocious acts, but they ultimately came to faith in Christ. How did you pick the 15?
Well, there's a lot of stories out there. The hardest ones to actually pick were to find the stories of women. And it wasn't that there hasn't been wicked women that have come to know the Lord throughout history. Oftentimes their stories weren't recorded. And so I had to search harder to find some stories because I wanted to span stories from the time of Jesus to the present and really from around the world. So from the area around Israel to here in the Western world as well.
You mentioned earlier that you think the people in the church tend to be less forgiving than they should be. I think the fact that we are made aware of details surrounding other people's sins makes us fully aware of the weight and gravity of offenses that have been committed. Why do you think the church, and we're generalizing, but for the sake of conversation, tend to be less forgiving when we're talking about those who have committed sins that are, by our measure, atrocious?
I think one of it is that question that's posed by the book as well, and that is, could I forgive that person? And, you know, it's one thing to even say, well, you know, Jesus can forgive that person, but would I be willing to forgive them and then also accept them?
Let's talk about what forgiveness in this context means. Presumably, these are not individuals who have offended me personally. I'm not the victim of their violent behavior, for example. But we know the details of who the victims were and what they suffered at the hands of those who committed these acts. What does forgiveness look like when I'm a third party? I'm an observer, but not directly involved in the case. And what is God calling us to do in responding to those who commit such atrocious offenses?
Well, one question to ask yourself is, what about one of these people that you hear in the news that, and again, you don't have to get into specifics, but did something atrocious, and then you suddenly find out they came to know the Lord, their life has been radically changed, and they show up at your church. Are you willing to accept them? Are you willing to be the person that sits down in the pew alongside of them? Are you willing to invite them to be part of your Sunday school class or your small group?
Are there circumstances under which it would be right to say no, as opposed to in every case, we should say yes?
Well, as always, and we work with at-risk children here in Nashville, and so you know, with that wide background of the parents, of the people that are in these families, sometimes a wide background between those who want to come and volunteer with us as well. And, you know, if someone's got a crime in their past that pertains to, you know, sexual acts with children, things of that sort, I'm not going to have them working with children. There's just, you know, safety that's involved in that. But that doesn't keep me from being able to forgive them and to accept them and to participate with them in things there I'm not potentially jeopardizing somebody else.
Yeah. The book we're talking about is titled Forever Unforgivable. And I think it's as much about how we extend forgiveness to others as it is about the tremendous depth and breadth of the grace and mercy of God, that even the worst among us, and I suppose we're all worse than we think we are, but even the worst among us can receive the grace and mercy of God when they come to him. As we are all called to come to him in faith. So it's a tremendous challenge to us in, I think, a number of ways. Can you select one of the offenders, if you will, that you the 15 that you list in the book, to give us an example of a heinous act and the redemption that followed?
One that fits in what we're hearing in the news today, because, I mean, people are out tearing down statues, is Nathan Bedford Forrest. And here in Nashville, where I live, there's a statue out by the highway of him, and he was a founder of the Ku Klux Klan. And this was a man that was known to be a racist, And if you stopped right there at the point where the Civil War ended and what had happened with the atrocities that he committed during that war and all the things that he stood for, yeah, I'd be out there tearing down that statue too. But that's not the end of his story. The end of his story is that he came to saving faith in Jesus Christ. And it became a real question. Were people willing to forgive him? Were people willing to accept him? And I include within that the African Americans of who he oppressed before that.
Was there fruit that followed this profession of faith that reflected this newfound relationship with Christ? Or did his life come to an end where his history was all that was known of him in terms of his works?
He didn't live for too many years after he became a believer, but in that time, yes, there was fruit, and enough so that there's recorded acts of where he actually worked actively to reconcile those that he had once harmed.
You know, it's such an interesting example because we are living in a time where we take a snapshot of someone's life and they are forever characterized by that set of evil deeds, if you will, and we don't necessarily look beyond that as the potential or the possibility that there was some sort of change. Now, we're going to take a quick break, but I want to continue this conversation as we look at others that are listed in this remarkable book, Forever Unforgivable, and to really examine what that means to forgive or to fail to forgive. Brent McDonald is my guest. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
We're back. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. My guest is Brent McDonald. He is the author of Forever Unforgivable. He does some pretty interesting work, at least it seems interesting to me. He is a pastor, teacher, and a Bible researcher with a focus on biblical archaeology and the historicity of Bible events. He lives in Nashville, Tennessee, and is the executive director of Cottage Grove Urban Ministries. He works with at-risk children and youth, and he enables and encourages people to live out lives of love for the least of these. He frequently travels with his wife, Angie, for on-site research in the Bible lands. So we've been talking about your book, Forever Unforgivable, that challenges us to consider the grace of God, the sufficiency of the sacrifice Christ made on our behalf so that we can be reconciled to God, and our call to forgive others. You know, we're even told if you fail to forgive, you're not going to be forgiven, which is a very sobering bit of scripture. As we mentioned earlier, you highlight the lives of 15 people that we would consider to be evil, and how they ultimately came to faith in Christ. And you challenge your readers to consider, would I be willing to embrace them if we came to a circumstance in which we were called to fellowship or even relationship? Let's talk a bit about your chapter on the sexual serial killer and cannibal. Jeffrey Dahmer comes to mind. I think I've heard people who have actually expressed anger that after having done all that he had done, that ultimately he came to faith in Christ, and somehow there was some injustice that he would be reconciled to Christ after having committed so many crimes. While incarcerated, he came to Christ. Can you tell us a bit of that story?
Yeah, and I mean, the best way to describe his story, one person who actually read my chapter on that, they sent me a one-word summary of it. He said, brutal. And it is. His life was brutal. Everything yes. about it was. And this was a person that many people would say he deserves everything he gets, whether we're talking that being thrown into prison, executed, or eternally. You know, most people, he deserves what he gets. But they don't realize we deserved it, too. Mm. And because of that, it was so easy for people to just write him off. You know, once he's caught, he's gone to prison. We don't care. Just, you know, lock him up, throw away the key type idea. And yet somebody was willing to say, this man needs Jesus as well, and then go and share the gospel with him, and not only have an opportunity to share the gospel with him, but then he came to faith in Jesus Christ. And yes, people would sometimes say that's not fair because he deserved that punishment. You mean he's not going to get it? Well, it doesn't mean the consequences here and now go away. Mm-hmm. But it does mean that he has eternal forgiveness. And, you know, so people will say, well, you know, that's not fair. But at the same time, you have to stop and consider that if he's a believer in Jesus Christ, you're going to spend eternity with him.
Yeah. And that's God's decision. That's not mine.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think part of the problem is we underestimate the weight and gravity of our own sin while we are very good at calculating the tremendous cost of other people's sin, we forget how far we have been separated from God by virtue of our sin nature and the sins that we have committed, while failing to extend that same recognition to others who are slaves to sin apart from a life in Christ. Would you say that that is at least a part of our problem in failing to forgive even the unforgivable?
Yes, definitely.
You have some contemporary examples, but there are some that are also ancient. Levi makes the book as well. Under your chapter on tax collectors and extortionists, talk a little bit about Levi and at least one ancient example of someone who was a pariah in his own day but came to faith in Christ.
Yeah, we're in this case specifically talking about tax collectors that were willing to compromise with the Roman occupiers of Israel and Judea at the time. And so, I mean, everybody hated Rome. I mean, Rome came in and did what it wanted, took what it wanted. And, you know, here you had somebody who was actually a Hebrew that was quite willing, for the sake of making a dollar, to compromise, to do whatever for their overlords, if you will. And so they were despised. They were known to extort money in any way they could so they could line their own pockets.
Also, among the 15 extraordinarily evil, John Newton makes the cut, someone we now have come to admire because of the legacy that he left behind. He had an encounter with faith. He stayed a racist human trafficker. But we, when we consider the whole of his life, have come to embrace him as a fellow believer. Can you talk a bit about John Newton and how it is that his reputation is somewhat redeemed in the minds of most believers as we look back over his life, but that doesn't necessarily extend to others who were equally guilty of grave offenses?
Well, John Newton, oftentimes when his story is told, it's kind of done in a summary form where you hear, here was a man who was a racist trafficker of human flesh, and suddenly he gets saved, and overnight he's just an anti-slavery person, somebody that wants to abolish slavery, and that's the end of the story. Like it's a radical change overnight. And one thing that happens is, for many of us, when we come to know the Lord, it doesn't change us instantly. The change starts, but it takes a long time. And are we willing to forgive and accept people even as God's still at work in their lives? Because, you know, so many times people say, well, if that person hasn't given up all their sin, you know, how can I accept them? Well, it takes somebody working in their lives to point out to them, to be able to share with them from scriptures, what is sin? And in John Newton's life, it took somebody spending time with him, actually more than one person, but, you know, one person mm-hmm. stood out, and I mentioned him in the book, and that kept working with him. And so his life was a progression of change. And that's what you see when God's at work in someone's life. You see that continually being changed.
Your final chapter is titled, What Will You Do? What's your challenge to readers? And I appreciate that you make this personal, because we can look at, you know, the broad swath of the church, for example, without really examining our own hearts. What is your challenge to readers?
Well, in summary, it's what we've been talking about all along. Are you willing to forgive and accept even as God in Christ has forgiven you? And mm-hmm. with that in mind, not only to possibly accept that person that comes into your sphere, whether it be at your church or your small group, but also, are you willing to even consider taking that message to that unlovable person? Because somebody's got to take that message of God's grace to them.
You mentioned it was a bit of a challenge to find women to include in the book. Did you find one? And who is she?
I actually found a few, and both in ancient history and some more recent, including a queen that is mm-hmm. part of what was now one of the states of the United States, and a Hawaiian queen. And I mean, she was involved in actually having people killed and human sacrifice. And so, you know, that's a story that most people here in the United States have never heard. Mm-hmm. And yet at the same time, she became a believer in Jesus Christ and somebody that was well known for what she did for the cause of Christ afterwards.
How was she received in her own community when that transformation occurred?
Within the believers, it was amazing how many accepted her and were willing to associate with her. And throughout history afterwards, many people have associated with her that have become believers in Jesus in that area.
Well, this is really a remarkable book, and I think it's also very timely when we are confronted with all kinds of questions about what we should harbor bitterness and resentment regarding and what we should forgive. And particularly for followers of Jesus, this is a very sobering command that we've been given. And I think you help us to really answer that question, what will I do when confronted with these similar circumstances? Thank you so much for the book and for taking the time to join us here today.
Thank you for having me.
Once again, the book is titled Forever Unforgivable, Learning to Forgive the Inexcusable for Christ's Sake. Brent McDonald, the author. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. We'll be back in a moment to wrap things up.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, welcome back. You're listening to the final segment of The Georgene Rice Show. By the way, I wanted to mention on Wednesday, we have a radiothon with Union Gospel Mission. As we all know, Thanksgiving is approaching. And while it may seem like really Thanksgiving already, we're going to talk about how we can come alongside those who live on the streets and primarily families in our community. More and more of them need our help for a Thanksgiving meal. So that's coming up on Wednesday. I hope you'll make plans to join us. Well, this was rather interesting to me. And in light of my conversation with Brent McDonald, it made me think about, am I praying for Kim Jong-un? Now, what an odd thing would that be to pray for this dictator who is starving his people to death? But I'm reminded by the book Forever Unforgivable that we have access to the throne of grace, and he has access to the human heart. He can change the might of the heart of a mighty king, just like he changes the course of a mighty river. So, you know, maybe we need to pick off some of these guys to begin earnestly praying for them. But Kim Jong-un wept as he begged for forgiveness for his failures during the coronavirus pandemic. We were told that North Korea had no cases at all, so this is very interesting. And he admitted that he's not always lived up to the trust that's been placed in him. He wiped away tears as he admitted his failures. And the main opposition leader in South Korea dismissed the display as appalling crocodile tears, which they may well have been. But North Korea unveiled a monstrous new intercontinental ballistic missile at a parade capable of reaching the United States. It's all in that context that his either sincere weeping or crocodile tears appeared. Well, Kim Jong-un wept during a huge military parade in North Korea. I suppose some of his people wept as well, as he issued this rare apology for his failures. The leader, in contrast to Boris Johnson, who has remained resolute and defensive despite facing criticism for his handling of the pandemic, showed his softer side as he showed as he removed glasses and wiped away his tears in unusually conciliatory tones. Well, North Korea claims to be totally free of the virus with no death, so I don't know why you would be admitting your failures, although this has been disputed. While Britain is on the brink of further lockdowns, so making that comparison is really kind of irrelevant to my point. But Kim said to the maskless crowd at the parade to mark the 75th anniversary of the country's ruling Workers' Party, according to a translation in the Korea Times, "Our people have placed trust as high as the sky and as deep as the sea in me, but I have failed to always live up to it satisfactorily. I am really sorry for that." I mean, the first mistake is to place your trust in him as high as the sky and as deep as the sea. I mean, that's what you do to the all-creator and sustaining God of the universe. And Kim is going to fall short of that. And of course, he and his those who have come before him believe that that is an apt description of who they are. But he went on to say, "Although I am entrusted with the important responsibility to lead this country, upholding the cause of the great comrades Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il, thanks to the trust of all the people, my efforts and sincerity have not been sufficient enough to rid our people of the difficulties in their lives." Well, analysts said the speech was a display of the mounting pressure on his regime. As Kim discussed the three hardships afflicting his people, COVID-19, which is non-existent, we've been told, international sanctions, and natural disasters. It's apparently not only been a strain on his people for decades, but now apparently a strain on him. Well, Hong Min, who's the director of the North Korean division of the Korea Institute for National Unification, told the Korea Times that underneath his message, one can sense that Kim is feeling a lot of pressure on his leadership. During the speech, he used terms like grave challenges, countless ordeals, and disasters unprecedented in history. Well, this shows that he is having a really hard time governing, and he feels pressured from worries that his people might be upset or swayed by this kind of difficulty. That is why he put a lot of emphasis on the people in this speech. Now, this might have been a sheer act of self-preservation, but it is rather interesting to see him posture in this way. Well, Kim Jong-un, the main opposition leader in South Korea, derided the teary display at the weekend's parade, referring to the shooting of a South Korean fisheries official by North Korean troops last month. He said it was appalling to see him shed crocodile tears after shooting our citizen to death. Well, during a parade, Kim unveiled a monster new intercontinental ballistic missile, which is capable of reaching the United States mainland. Analysts said the missile, which has was shown on a transported vehicle with 11 axles, would be one of the largest road mobile intercontinental ballistic missiles in the world if it becomes operational. This missile is a monster, said Melissa Hanham, who's the deputy director of the Open Nuclear Network. Also displayed were the Hwangsong 15, which is the longest range missile ever tested by North Korea, and what appeared to be a new submarine-launched ballistic missile. A senior U.S. administration official called the display of the ICBM disappointing and called on the government to negotiate to achieve a complete denuclearization. Yeah, good luck with that. Well, the parade featured North Korea's ballistic missiles for the first time since Kim began meeting with international leaders, including the U.S. President Donald Trump back in 2018. We will continue, Kim said, to build our national defense power and self-defensive war deterrence. But he vowed that the country's military power would not be used preemptively. He made no direct mention of the United States or the now stalled denuclearization talks. Apparently, he's gotten what he wanted out of that. Kim blamed international sanctions, typhoons, and the coronavirus for preventing him from delivering on promises of economic progress. I am ashamed that I have never been able to repay you properly for your enormous trust, he said. My efforts and devotion were not sufficient to bring our people out of difficult livelihoods. The video showed Kim make an appearance as the clock struck midnight, dressed in a gray suit and tie. He waved to the crowd, accepted flowers from children while surrounded by military officials in Pyongyang's renovated Kim Il-sung Square. The parade was highly choreographed. Thousands of troops marched in formation, displays of new conventional military equipment, and so on. Experts said that the new larger ICBM is likely designed to carry multiple independent reentry vehicles. I have no idea, but that would allow it to attack more targets and make interception more difficult. Now, most of us have some notion of the leadership of Kim Jong-un. We know something of his family history and how his predecessors led, how the people have suffered there, how closed the country is, how opposed he is to Christianity and so on. But in light of all that he has done against his people and others, in light of my conversation with the author of Forever Unforgivable, I wonder if we would do well to remember to pray for him as fervently as we might pray for a niece or nephew who has yet to come to faith in Christ. If we pray for world leaders and ask that they would have an encounter with Christ in whatever way God might choose, that would lead to saving faith. Now, that might just seem ridiculous. It might seem outrageous. I mean, Kim Jong-un coming to faith in Christ? Yeah, I kind of like the idea. What about others who are considered the leaders of rogue nations? I wonder if we would pray for them and ask God to intervene, if we would fervently lift up their names, if we might see some change in these countries and among these leaders. It's just a thought. As we're praying for our own nation, as we're praying for our leaders, as we're praying for those who are frustrated and angry among us, as we pray for those who deface things that have been held and cherished in our country, whether or not they should be, you can decide for yourselves. As people are lashing out in anger and hatred and frustration and fear, this is a time when we have access, full access to the throne of grace, and ask God to intervene, to give wisdom to our own leaders and perhaps to other leaders around the world whose decisions have impact on hundreds of thousands of people under their leadership. Well, we are out of time. I want to thank James Blend for producing today's program, Clark Hilton for engineering, and Dan Rice for the use of his office. And thank you for making the Georgine Rice Show part of your day. Have a great night.
Thanks for listening to the Georgine Rice Show podcast. If you'd like to download a podcast of the show or would like more information on today's guests, please visit the show at kpdq.com or on Facebook. Follow the show on Twitter at GRice Show and like us on Facebook. And join us live every weekday at 4 for more critical thinking for critical times on 93.9 KPDQ.